one of the reasons that I am so tied to covey birds in the wide open now is because somebody asked me recently, they were hunting with me and my dog Quest, who is a Llewellyn setter, and he's a solid 300-yard dog. I've lost count of the number of times he's gone on point and he's at 450 or even 500. They've asked me, is he my best dog? And I've thought about this a lot because I've been very fortunate. I've had some great dogs. And I have to say, for what I want to do now, yes, he's the best dog I've ever had.
Come here, Emmy.
Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Your host, Nick, here, checking in with a couple of updates before we get to our full conversation with Todd Baumgartner of Pack Mule Training Co. If you're watching this and not just listening, you can see behind me, there's no snow outside the Birdshot Podcast studios, which is the first time in a while I've been able to say that. That means spring is here, and I'm thinking about turkey season. If all goes according to plan, I will be hitting the woods this weekend with my boys for the first time this year. So really hoping to get out into the turkey woods soon. And with that in mind, I wanted to mention the promo code we have for Meadow Creek Mounts. If you caught the last episode on the show, we interviewed Greg Mayhair of Meadow Creek Mounts. You can use the promo code BSP10 to save 10% on a mount or a red dot sight if you don't need a mount from Meadow Creek Mounts. Greg sent out the Vortex Viper red dot sight and his special custom fit mount for my Mossberg SA28. The boys and I got that set up. It was really easy. We took it out and got it all dialed in this week. Can't wait to hit the woods with it, but worked out really, really well. And again, as we talked about in the episode with Greg, I like having it out on the rib versus where my gun is drilled and tapped. And that's kind of what Meadow Creek does. So really, really love the setup. Hopefully we'll get to put it to the test for real this weekend, and I'll let you all know how that goes. But promo code BSP10, Meadow Creek Mounts. Check that out if you like. All right. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Keith, welcome back to the show, buddy.
Great to be here.
Thank you for joining us today. It was, I probably shouldn't do this anymore, but 2021, the last time you were on the show, 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
It's crazy. That's how long I've been doing this. And obviously you've been chasing birds for a lot longer than that, which is why we have you on the show today. You took a fun trip this last year. We're going to get into that. It's great to have you back on. Like I said, I will, before we get into the meat of the conversation today, I will ask you, have you been tempted by the turkeys at all this spring?
A little bit, not nearly as much as you are. And congratulations to your son for shooting his first bird. That's pretty cool. Oh, yeah. But as I think I've told you before, I now have what I'm sure is a hen nesting on our property because I see her almost every afternoon picking through the grass. And I keep my dogs in now because I don't want them to, the hen is, I'm sure, nested, as I said, because the toms are still calling and they're down in the valley. But, I don't get too excited about it unless if I hear something gobble in the morning, then I think about it pretty hard. But So far, yeah. I have
you,
not
you set
actually
your coffee
picked
mug
up a gun.
Down and think
exactly.
about heading back
yeah.
there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I love it. Well, for listeners that didn't catch your episode 5 years ago and maybe aren't familiar with who you are, give us a little background, kind of who you are, where you are, and put us on the map a little bit as you are a bird hunter.
Sure. Started bird hunting a long, long time ago. I was, to put it in perspective, I graduated high school in 76. And by then I was pretty avid bird hunter. Spent most of my earlier days in terms of bird hunting in the Northeast. Lived in upstate New York for a lot of that time. Got to hunt around that area. And then I actually moved to what I called purgatory for 4 years. I was in Illinois. And to put that in perspective, when I moved to Illinois, and by then I had a couple of bird dogs and was you know, a really avid hunter. I called Game and Fish just to say, hey, can you give me some idea of where I might, you know, I'm an avid bird hunter, where I'd like to know where to hunt. I'm not looking for, you know, spots in particular, but if you could just point me in the right direction. And the biologist that I talked to said, yeah, I could point you in the right direction. Go to Iowa. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, you know, I thought Illinois was farm country. And he said, those days are long gone. He said, this is all agribusiness now. Everything's fence row to fence row planted. We don't have the cover. And he turned out to be right. And I did.
That was in the 80s, or are we talking 90s?
That would have been in the early 90s. Yeah. Okay, early 90s. And actually, you know, I got lucky, ran into a guy that had raised and trained springers, and he had some good contacts in Illinois. And so we did go to Illinois almost every weekend for, you know, during the pheasant season. So did that for a while.
So did that for a while.
And then from there moved to Wyoming. That was in 1999, and kind of fell in love with chuckers and Huns first. And then, cause chuckers are harder, and then chuckers as well. And then, actually, and I don't know whether you and I have ever talked about this, but there was a year where I had been here for quite a while, and I decided, it was during the pandemic, and I decided that I had never shot a rough grouse in Wyoming. And so I put together this thing that I called my grouse slam, and went around to shoot the various grouse you can shoot in Wyoming, and got that accomplished. So anyway, been in Wyoming since the late 90s, and still hunt, travel quite a bit to hunt, especially now that I'm retired. So, a lot around the Intermountain West, but also down to Arizona, some back to like North Dakota, more for, the prairie grouse than the pheasants. I think you and I have discussed, I'm not a big fan of ditch parrots. So I don't chase them that often. So that's where I am now. I'm here and I do get to hunt quite a bit, average, maybe, you know, 60, 70 days a year, chasing whatever there is out there.
Yeah. That sounds like fun to me. Now you probably told me, but was it work that brought you west, or was it the birds, or was it a little bit of both?
It was work. It was work that took me to Illinois, and then it was I changed jobs and joined a small engineering firm out here in Laramie, Wyoming, and as I was getting ready to retire, my wife and I started looking for another area of Wyoming, and so we wound up further north and almost on the Wyoming-Montana border, and that's where we've been for the last 10 years.
Were you retired when I interviewed you back in 2021? Was that after, or were you still working a little bit?
I retired in January of 21. I had gone part-time in 2017. And that was the year that I did what I called my odyssey, what I hooked up my trailer, put the two bird dogs in it, and hunted. I left home the beginning of October and came back 2 days before Christmas. Having hunted, I think I can't remember the numbers anymore, but it was something like 11 or 12 states and about the same number of species. And okay, best fall of my life.
Do you think, would that have been the fall that you were out at Pine Ridge and we spent the day in the woods together?
No, that would have been later.
I did go to
Pine Ridge. I think it was just a couple of years after that, if I remember right.
Okay. Because I thought I interviewed you after that, but neither here nor there.
Yeah.
You were up in the mountains over the weekend. Were you doing some fishing up there?
I wasn't. Actually, we went to go check out a new area on BLM property that we scouted it last year when we were camping in the mountains on the west side of the mountains. We found this spot, and it's a really, really neat place location wise. The views are incredible. And we thought that it was definitely a place that you'd want to camp early, because it sits out there right on the edge of the desert and it's going to get hot and there's no trees. So we went to check that out, and some friends of ours actually were camped out there, and we knew they were going to be there. So we went and joined up with them, and kind of thought it was pretty cool until two nights ago when I took a post dinner walk with my wife, into on a little trail that was behind where we were camped, and came out onto the gravel road that we were camped on, and like walked right into a rattlesnake. And what was really weird was like 10 minutes earlier, I had just taken the dogs on the same walk and they were loose. And so the snake wasn't there at that time. So I could send you a picture of that too. But yeah, that area, I don't know if you are aware of this, but is the general rule of thumb out here in the West is if you're 7,000 feet or above, rattlesnakes don't live there. And I'm sure there's exceptions to that, but that's kind of the rule of thumb. In all of my years living in Laramie, which is at 7,200 feet, never saw a rattlesnake there, in that country right around town. But where I am now, there's plenty of areas around here where it's more like 4,000 or 5,000 feet. And we were at, I think, 4,700 at the campground when the rattlesnakes are there. So good place to avoid if you can.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. It sounds like it.
Yeah. Well, at this point in time, both of my dogs are snake avoidance trained.
Oh, yeah, you've done that, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it seems to have worked very well. Like 2 years after I did it the first time, I brought them to another training, and they wouldn't even go. I mean, they dragged me away from the snake when I had them on the leash. So at least for a couple of years, it was still fresh in their minds, and
dogs
imprint pretty well on that kind of stuff. So
where did you go to do that snake breaking?
The first time that I did it was down in Tucson. I was, my wife and I rented a place down there for a month or so. I don't know, that's probably been 4 years ago, I think. And then when I went to redo it, it was here at home. My younger dog, as you know, I have Llewellyns, and my younger dog, who's now five, the year that I got the snake breaking done was the same year that he got bit in October.
Okay. And so I thought you had had a dog bit, cause that's coming back to me now.
Yeah. Yeah. He got bit and he was vaccinated, and I know some people don't believe in that the vaccine works, but
yeah.
Where I live, my vet said, he said, I probably see 100, bites a year. And he said, I could tell you at least, in my experience, anecdotally, he said the dogs that have been vaccinated fare much better than the dogs that have not been. Mm-hmm. So he said it's not a question of whether it's going to probably save their life or not, because rattlesnake bites don't typically kill a dog. But he said, He looked at my dog, who looked terrible. His head was like, you know, half the size of a basketball. He got bit right in the neck. And he said that dog's head would be twice the size if he hadn't been vaccinated. So,
yeah, 100 yeah. bites a year, a pretty good sample size.
Yeah, it is a pretty good sample size.
Were you hunting? Was that off season training? How did the encounter happen?
Yeah, I was hunting. We were hunting sharptails. Had flushed a small group off of a kind of a sage hillside, and they had fanned out into a, you know, a grassy kind of meadow, and I went down following the dogs. And I was watching Homer, was the dog that got bit. He had his head stuck in a mountain mahogany bush. And as I watched him, he just sort of did what I call the reverse fox pounce. He bounded out backwards. Yeah. You know, you can sort of picture that. Yeah. And I walked over there and I used my gun barrel to sort of push the branches aside, and there was a snake, and it was up and ready. And I was like, well, you know, I thought maybe he didn't actually get struck.
Right. So maybe just startled out of there.
Yeah. I looked him over really closely and didn't see anything, but I thought, you know, for the, you know, discretion, the better part of valor. So I put a leash on him and we walked back. My truck was only a couple hundred yards away got him up on the tailgate and was just sitting there watching him. And I scratched him under the neck and I could feel already the swelling underneath his throat. And so I carry steroid shots because I had the vet that I had for many years did not believe in the vaccine and always told me his thing was, he said he had never lost a dog to a rattlesnake bite if he could get a steroid shot into it within an hour. And so, every few years I renew that, that batch of shots, and I had one with me and I gave him that, got back into cell coverage and called my vet and said, hey, I'm coming in. Dog just got bit. And by the time I got there, he checked him out and said, well, you already did everything we would do. So he looks like he's fine. His, you know, everything seems to be as normal as can be. And he said, if it was my dog, I'd take him home and keep him rested and he'll probably be okay in a few days. He was.
Man. Yeah. That's obviously not something anybody wants, but that can happen to anybody out there. Jason, birds in the right place or wrong place, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. You know what? It's what's really strange about it, because, and I was a guy that up until that incident, I would have been the guy that, you know, you would say, what about snakes? And I would have said, oh God, I've been hunting out here for almost 20 years and I've seen one or two and never had a problem. But the next year, I saw 9 in the first 2 months of the season, and nothing different. I was hunting pretty much the same kind of covers that I had always hunted and never had a bite, but ran into snakes. I ran into them more often than I think the dogs did. The dogs are usually going so fast that if they don't care, you know, then they don't, it's not going to be a problem. But, you know, there's an old saying for hikers that it's never the first person that gets bit by the snake. It's the second one. Because by then the snake is up and ready.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. Nice. Well, yeah. Good encounter story there. And
I don't know. I think I would almost take our rattlesnakes over your ticks. You know, I just hate the ticks in Northwoods.
That's interesting, because I hear that from a lot of Western hunters. And I mean, from a frequency perspective, it's like rattlesnake one in 20 years, like your dog's okay, obviously, but the ticks, it's like a constant, you know, covered in them always. Yeah. So, I mean, I do get that to a certain extent, and where I'm basically numb to the ticks. Like I just,
right.
You see them every day. And I mean, I have not knock on wood, I haven't had Lyme disease or anything like that. But I take
how many times a year? How many times a year do you have to pull one off that's gotten into you?
So you know what? This is really interesting. Like I now I'm knocking on wood very hard because I feel like ticks, maybe they don't like some people seem to get bit more than others. And I don't know if there's a thing to that. I've never really looked into it, but I rarely, if ever, like I can't remember the last time I had a tick actually biting me. I mean, I'll see them on my pant legs and flick them off. It's kind of like a tailgate check. You know, I kind of look and I spray my pants with permethrin, but again, I haven't found ticks on me. When I take my boys into the woods, we were in the woods yesterday doing trail camera stuff. I mean, I'm checking them over with like a magnifying glass just because I don't want to take any chances. But I don't know. They don't seem to like me, or either that or my precautions are good enough spraying the pants, but I'm not doing that every single day. Like, I don't want to give people the wrong impression here. Last season, I think I sprayed my pants with some Sawyer's permethrin spray, and then I've been experimenting with some of the newer non-toxic. There's Wonderside and Cedarside. I've been spraying that on the dog pads and stuff. And I mean, the dogs are always going to have ticks on them, but I give mine an ingestible tick medicine, and then I spray their kennel pads. And I don't that combination. I don't find engorged ticks on the dogs, and that's kind of, you know, what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I have found engorged ticks on the dogs, and my dogs are on Simpatica, and the ticks are dead, but they've like gotten halfway blown up, and you just kind of just almost wipe them off. The interesting thing is that the only time that I've been bitten by a tick in my adult life, like where it got, you know, got in and got fully engorged, was when I was at Pine Ridge. Yeah. And I was in a cabin, and Chip, my buddy that I was traveling with, was in a different cabin. And in the middle of the night, I just kind of rubbed the back of my arm, and it was like, as soon as I felt it, I was like, oh damn, you know? And I got up in the middle of the night and I was like, you know, do I try and get it off? Because they always tell you the first 24 hours are kind of key with respect to Lyme's disease. Yep. And so I wound up pulling it with a pair of tweezers, and I'm sure I didn't get the whole thing. It was on the back side of my arm, and I couldn't, you know, I couldn't see it well. But all the guides at Pine Ridge told me that I should just take one of those Doxy horse pills, and if I took one a day for 2 days, I'd be fine. And I was like, and particularly, I forget the name of who was the old guy that was like always had all these leather things that he made himself. Earl was like, yeah, you just need to take this. And I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm taking advice from Earl on this, you know. And so,
best take it with a grain of salt.
When I got home, I actually just called my doctor, who happens to be originally from upstate New York, just random. And I said, what do I need to do? And he was like, well, you need to take full-on doxycycline for a month, because I've lived where Lyme disease, you know, he knew all about Lyme disease, which I could have gone to almost any other doctor here and they would not have. Yeah, I mean, they'd have looked in the book or whatever he said. But, you know, so, and, you know, any antibiotic for a month is kind of a pain for a variety of reasons. And so, but that was, you know, that was what he said, you know, that was the only way, because it had been, by the time I went to see him, it had been almost a week after I got bit. So anyway, yeah, my other memory from that trip was, I remember when I hunted, the one day I hunted with Jerry, and he was spraying some kind of horse medicine on his dogs, like every time he let them out of the out of the truck, and I was like, that can't be good. You know, I mean, it's just, I mean, if it's okay for a horse that weighs whatever, a couple thousand pounds, I don't know, putting it on a dog seems like you should adjust somehow. I don't know. But I mean, he's been doing it forever, I guess, right?
Right. Yep. And I had had to use that something similar probably in the past. If you go to like, you know, your Tractor Supply or Fleet Farm, they sell like a in the usually in the horse section, they've got something. I have a feeling that that stuff's diluted pretty good, but
yeah,
I don't,
probably
know that for a fact. But you can buy stuff. You can buy stuff that is, you can order it like permethrin spray for your dogs. And that, again, that's where I've gone to, like when I'm actually spraying it on the dogs, I'm opting for that Wonder Side or the Cedar Side, which is basically just like essential oils. And I'm just, they're already taking the ingestibles, so I don't necessarily need to put permethrin on top of that as kind of what I think. But, and it's, I don't know, both my dogs have tested, like when we do the annual thing, they'll test antibodies for like anaplasmosis. I don't know if I've had a Lyme positive. I feel like I probably have, but I've never, it's always been asymptomatic. Like I've never noticed anything in my dog where they've had, but that's, I know plenty of people that have had their dogs have tick bite, Lyme disease, lethargy, lame, you know, their back leg. I mean, it's kind of a head scratcher in many ways, like who it affects, how it affects them. And again, when you feel like you can't go into the woods without like getting ticks on you, it's, I could see how somebody that, if you don't have to deal with that all the time, that's kind of a, it's not something you enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, we have ticks, but,
But
it's like now, you know, and that's when you get most of them. Is like at turkey hunting, you would definitely worry about ticks, but by the time the fall rolls around, the heat usually is what gets rid of them, and they're, you know, they're gone by September. So,
well, that's enough about ticks and snakes. Keith, what do you say we talk about woodcock?
Sure, let's talk about woodcock.
Well, I want to go. So I'm curious now. I was reading an article that you had sent me, and we maybe chatted about this, but I don't know. New Brunswick. I want to. You took a trip there, and that kind of like, I feel like that as you wrote, it kind of changed you. I think that was what became like the trip where you kind of really became a traveling hunter. Is that correct?
Right. That is correct. I started off. The first really destination hunt that I did was actually to Texas.
That one I remember.
Yeah.
You ran your dog for like 4 days straight and he slept 24 hours on the way
home. Yeah, exactly. And again, there was this guy that I worked with who had his own line of Ryman setters and was just, in fact, to really put this in perspective for you, it turns out that the guide that I used in New Brunswick had guided some quite famous people, both salmon fishing and woodcock hunting. And one of his regular customers was Gene Hill. And he was telling me that he was showing me a book that he had that was signed to him by Gene Hill, you know, and there was a story in that book, which if you're interested, I'll go dig it out and figure out which one it was. But it was about this guy that I was working with who I had no idea. And it didn't put him in the best light because the point that Gene Hill was making when he wrote the story was how it must be like not a great thing to be such a fantastic shot that you never miss. Because he was at this lodge, this guy that I worked with was at the same lodge, and every day when they came back at the end of the day, this guy would have put 8 empty 28 gauge shells on this fence post or whatever it was, and 8 was the limit in birds, and he would have a limit of birds and 8 empties every time. And Gene Hill kind of was waxing poetic on that. That would be terrible, right? I mean, if you never missed, I mean, what would be the point, right? So anyway, so I met this guy before any of that happened. And I was telling him about about just coming back from Texas and how many birds we saw and how great it was. And he just looked at me like I was sick. And he was like, why would you drive 30 whatever hours it is to go to Texas to hunt amidst rattlesnakes when you could just drive 15 hours and be in the best woodcock hunting probably on the planet, you know? And I was like, well, where's that? And so New Brunswick was where it was. And he hooked me up with this guide whose name was Danny Bird. Oh, lie.
Love that.
Yep. And Danny was this short, kind of stout, probably in his late 40s, maybe 50 at the time. Had a English setter and was just woodcock. I mean, to the point where we did not hunt grouse. We hunted woodcock. We shot plenty of grouse, but his approach was the exact opposite of yours, which was you figure out. I mean, what you've said numerous times is I'll go hunt grouse, and I'm going to run into enough woodcock, you know, to shoot some woodcock. His attitude was, we'll hunt woodcock and we'll see plenty of grouse. And every day when you left the house, he would come out, he'd pick up a stick when you got to the first cover, and he'd kind of get it to where it was maybe 18 inches long. And he would, one end, he would cut a notch for every woodcock that we ever flushed. And the other end he'd cut. Yeah. And the other, so he'd count the birds on a stick, and he made notes at the end of the day. And we had days where we moved, you know, 60, 70 woodcock. And
little notches on that 18-inch sticks.
Yeah. And then at the same time, maybe 30 grouse, you know.
Yeah,
and those grouse there were kind of what people call fool hens, you know, out west. Yeah, they'd jump up into the lowest branch of a tree, and you know, I mean, you got enough shooting that it could be challenging, but they just never saw anybody hunting, you know? And so I just fell in love with the whole thing. The cover was classic. Danny was a classic, you know, he just was very philosophical, and we'd almost always end the day parked on the edge of some field. And he would say, I tell you this, boys, if you were to stay here for the evening, it would scare you the number of birds that would be coming out of those woods and landing in this field. He said, you can't even believe. And we would often, as we were driving down muddy roads into the covers, he'd stop, get out, make us all get out, and show us all the bore holes around the puddles that were in the, you know, that were in the road. And it was just a, you know, he'd be driving down the road and he'd see mushrooms on the side of the road, and those will go perfect with woodcock. We got to collect some mushrooms so that we can add them to dinner. And he was just all about woodcock. I mean, honest to God, he was fanatic about two things. One was Atlantic salmon and the other one was woodcock, and the grouse were just an extra. So, and I just came back
to New Brunswick to me from what I know of it.
Yeah. It's, you know, and in those days, I don't know what the limit is anymore up there.
Right.
It probably isn't eight, but I don't know. At the time, probably it was still five in the U.S. in those days. But it was 18, I mean, eight there. And we had on that very first trip, we had a funny deal. We kind of collected we shot a lot of woodcock and we ate a lot of woodcock, but we collected or kept enough that we had just the total number, you know, that we were allowed to bring into the States to have in possession in Canada. And when we got to customs, the guy on the U.S. side, as we were coming back in, he was like, what are you doing? We said, we were hunting woodcock. And he said, Do you have any? And we said, yeah, we've got some. And he said, well, how, you know, fill out these forms. And we're still, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, we're driving back, and we're, were the three of us, me and my two buddies, were like, we're each filling out our own form. And one of my buddies is like, well, I think I only shot this many. I'll, you know, and I was like, well, I think I've brought back this many. We were making the mistake of actually trying to count how many birds each one of us, so that it added up to the right number. But when I handed the guy my sheet, which had more than the amount I was allowed, he was like, are you sure you don't want to, like, change these numbers so that you each have the same number? And I was like, oh yeah, okay. So yeah, we just, like, it was, yeah, he gave us a break. But at the end of the day, we said he gave us a break, and I've never asked anybody since, but, like, what is the rule? The guy in New York, I didn't think that he had any way to keep us, within the limits of the Canadian law. Because as soon as we crossed the border, we had more than you were allowed in New York, for sure.
Right.
I didn't know how that supposedly worked, but.
Yeah. That trip. Now, I interviewed some guys from New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, last fall. And that's always been, a lot of literature, a lot of magazine articles. I've interviewed a guide up there, Jason Curtis, I recall. I want to get him back on the show, actually. I mean, I think I talked about this before with somebody, living in this part of the world, I guess you think about, you cross the border into Canada and it's, walleye fishing and, like, northern pike and just, like, that allure of going up, to Canada and the game being bountiful and it, for all intents and purposes, I mean, it is in many ways. It's like not as many people there, tons of land for the right things. I would like to do that. Was that the only time you went to New Brunswick?
No. And probably the next I think that was 86, probably the next 10 years, maybe, maybe a little less. I probably went to New Brunswick, I don't know, 8 or 10 times. And the reason I got lucky, one of the things that I was very fortunate in my career writ large was that I traveled a lot, but I got to travel to some pretty good places. So I became pretty good friends with Danny, the guide. I think we did 3 trips purposefully to hunt with him. But then I got to the point where I was working for a company that my territory, I was doing environmental remediation, and my territory included Eastern Canada. And so I had Quebec, I had New Brunswick, I had Nova Scotia, and those were the main places that I went. And I'd have these projects where I'd have to go up there and be out in the field for, it's 3-4 days, overseeing some work that was being done. And I think 3 different times I went to New Brunswick and I stayed at Danny's house and we hunted. I didn't have to bring a gun or anything. I would just go up and he'd lend me. And the rules were, I can't remember exactly how they worked, but, like, depending on what level guide he was, he could guide up to 3 people, but he couldn't guide. He wasn't supposed to guide for free, basically. So he had to treat me like on a special. He would just say, we're just friends going, and if anybody asks, I'm not guiding you. We're just hunting together, And so I hunted with him a number of times, staying at his house. And those were always like a day or 2 days. And then probably one of the more interesting and kind of adventurous trips I did, one of the guys that I hunted with a lot, this guy George, he had a client, he was an accountant, and he had a client who had a cabin up in Quebec. And we went up there and hunted for a week. And that was very interesting because it was no guide, no, there was no such thing as GPS and OnX. So we literally went into a sporting goods store when we got up there and bought the topo sheets for the area, and then studied those, and then went and hunted quite successfully. Hunted, never saw anybody else hunting, saw plenty of moose, found a lot of woodcock. And then the one other trip I did up into that area was, believe it or not, that they're, so this is opposite what I've said about pheasants when you and I talk with them. We actually made a trip to hunt pheasants in Nova Scotia because I read an article that pointed out that Nova Scotia and the Annapolis Valley in particular was like the highest population density of wild pheasants in North America outside of South Dakota. And it was, and they were all wild. They had been released like right after the World War, and it was farm country. And again, we needed a guide, and we hired a guy that should not have been guiding bird hunters. He was a salmon guide, and he didn't have a dog, but he could borrow a dog. And the dog he could borrow was a golden retriever, and not saying anything that's bad about that. But my point is, he had no clue what kind of cover we wanted to hunt as guys with pointing dogs. And so it was the only.
So you guys had your own dogs also?
Yeah, we brought our dogs with us. Okay.
Yeah.
And we kept trying to say to him, you know, this is the kind of cover we need to hunt effectively, you know, to be effective. And he would keep taking us to these like long ditches that, you know, you needed to put two guys at the other end a half mile away, because you always saw a lot of pheasants. You know, they came boiling out the back end, but you know, we didn't get to shoot too many of them. So that was another interesting trip. So I probably, you know, made, I'm going to say it was 10 or more trips up there over the course of, you know, sometimes I went like three times in a year, like when I was doing projects.
How long ago was the last time you went north of the border with dog and gun? Like, was that going back a ways?
No, that would have been 2018. I went to Alaska, I drove up with, we pulled our trailer, my wife and I spent with, my two kids joined us, and we spent a week doing stuff as a family, including salmon fishing. And then everybody left, and my wife pointed out that she didn't need to drive both ways. So she flew home, which it was actually fine, because my plan was to try and hunt ptarmigan on the way back. And then also I had been doing a lot of research on where I could hunt forest grouse, blue grouse and rough grouse in British Columbia. And in fact had made arrangements to stay at a lodge where they were going to just let me park my camper and go hunt unguided. But it turned out that where their lodge was, everything was burning that year. And they actually had to evacuate, so I couldn't hook up with them. So I wound up just deciding I'd go on my own. And I, you know, you're driving down through British Columbia, and there's all this crown land that looks, I mean, it just looks like grouse cover, you know, I mean. So I actually went to Smithers, British Columbia, and the snag that I hit was, the British Columbian government had just implemented a new regulation that you could not hunt. You could not get a license to hunt if you did not have a hunter safety card, like in hand, which I tried to say, A, I have one. I don't have it with me. I got it when I was 16, which is a long, long time ago. B, I can show you the licenses that I have in my pocket from four different states in the United States, all of which require hunter safety. And they were like, you know, there's a place on this form that says, I need the number that's on your card. And I kind of went, really? Like, you're not going to let me stay here in this area eat and buy gas and support your economy, you're going to tell me that I can't hunt. And they said, oh, you could hunt if you could find a guide, because you don't need a hunter safety card if you hunt with a guide. I said, that seems like a good way to shoot a guide. If that, I don't know what your, I'm not sure what your logic is, but anyway, long and the short of it was I literally had to bag the whole last part of my trip because I couldn't get a license. So,
okay. So, well, I was only curious about just like, again, border crossing with dog and gun. And I guess that was maybe pre-pandemic. So maybe things have changed. I've never done it personally. I've heard, obviously, plenty of people do it. Can be done. Just kind of curious about the logistics.
Yeah, it's really the most important thing that I think I would tell people is to make sure they understand the both coming and going. Everybody looks at it as, okay, I'm going into Canada, I need to have the paperwork for Canada, and they don't think about they need the paperwork coming back. Like so you're supposed to, as you leave the United States, you're supposed to check in with U.S. Customs and register that you're taking these guns out of the country so that they know you didn't buy them when you were gone and you can bring them back. And so on that Alaska trip, in fact, I crossed back into the country in a tiny little border town up in Montana. You know, no line, no wait, you know, just pulled up. It's kind of like 6 o'clock. I'm on my way to my daughter's house. She lives like 50 miles from the border up there. And the guy was like, he was kind of nice, but he was a little bit sarcastic. And he said, hey, when was this, you know, have you crossed into Canada before? I said, well, yeah, I have. It's been many years, but I have done it into New Brunswick several times in Quebec. And he says, well, to the best of my knowledge, the laws regarding you having to register your gun when you leave the country have not changed in those 20 years. So I'm a little disappointed that you didn't get your guns, you know, registered. And I was like, yeah. And I was like, damn, sorry. But it has been 20 years and I'm getting old, so I don't remember that well. So. But I remember now.
Yeah.
So he gave me a break. He just made his point and said, you know, remember. And it, by the way, it's not just guns. Like if you were bringing expensive camera equipment, you should register that. Because it's for all the same reason. They just want to make sure that you're not buying it there and bringing it here.
Yeah. Running your own little personal arbitrage scheme.
Yeah. The other thing that you can't do, probably you've already heard this, you cannot carry a pistol into Canada. So
I didn't know that. I hadn't really thought about it, but yeah, it makes sense.
I mean, the only reason I know that is because many of the people who are going to Alaska are going to hunt. You know, if they're going to hunt, they're going to be running into bears. Even people who are fishing might want a pistol. And I talked to several guys that said, yeah, I'm just going to buy a pistol when I get there and then I'll sell it, you know, before I leave. So they just do that to avoid the, you know.
Yeah. I want to continue this thread of woodcock and we want to talk about Scott. I was curious before we talk about that, when you were DIY hunting in Quebec, like in finding, like, were you hunting timber cuts? Like what kind of stuff were you looking for finding birds, just out of curiosity?
You know, with the topo sheet, which obviously doesn't tell you much about, I mean, it tells you where the swamps are, which is, we were looking for things like, you know, you look for the white spots, which are, you know, you're in an area that if there are fields, they've been cleared. And so for the most part, we would look to hunt the edges of those. We did a lot of scouting where we just put, you know, X's on the map and then drove around and looked for them. And by then I was good enough where I could often even tell, like we'd get into a spot, we'd find splash, but no birds. And, you know, my buddy would say, well, you know, they must've left. And I would say, I don't know. This looks like it's morning cover. You know, I think this is where they're coming out of the field. They're going to be, it's the afternoon. I think they're up on those hillsides, you know, instead. So, sounds like you got a dog that wants to go in or out.
Yeah. Hartley's just moving around a little,
but yeah, we did it all on topos. We just did it with maps. Yeah.
So you are now, obviously, as we discussed, you're primarily a Western bird hunter. You spend most of your time out there, but the woodcock, you haven't lost love for the woodcock.
No, and the pull is still there.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. You know, I have I've talked to Western bird hunters. Some have never experienced hunting woodcock. Others maybe have, but sometimes there's a, most notably, I remember some rough grouse hunters like from the Northwest. They kind of almost had like a disdain for the woodcock and the joining of Rough Grouse Society and American Woodcock Society. I don't always remember that, but you have not lost love for the woodcock, and you've chased them kind of all around North America. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some notable places, but
right.
there was a would you call it a final frontier?
The final frontier? You mean Louisiana?
No. I mean your trip across the
pond. Oh, the final frontier to go across the pond. Yeah. I don't think I used that phrase, but that's good.
No.
Yeah. Once I had, and just, you probably don't even remember this, but when I went to Pine Ridge, my main reason for going to Pine Ridge, because I'd been hunting woodcock and grouse in about an hour, maybe northwest of there for several years up near Cass Lake. And I, you know, I've been up there and certainly feel more than confident that I can find woodcock if they're in town, and you know, same for grouse. But I had gotten into talking to Jerry Havel over a period of a couple of weeks, and just said, you know, I would love to come out and do like a master class in woodcock. I would love to, like, if somebody who really knows woodcock, like a biologist who knows woodcock, could go out and say, oh, you know, because the birds should be here. There's probably local birds still around, but the covers are kind of dry. And that particular year, it was very dry.
It was warm and dry. I remember that.
And my buddy Chip and I hunted for a week before going to Pine Ridge, and we found more grouse than woodcock by far, and we were looking for woodcock. Yeah. And it was kind of a perfect setup. So when we went to Pine Ridge, I think it was day one, Jerry put us with a guy who had just finished his master's in woodcock. And he was the Minnesota small game habitat manager. And I'm sorry, I don't remember his name.
I wonder if it was maybe Kyle. He works for, he's a fish and wildlife now.
Yeah, but he was like a, well, I mean, I could tell you this particular guy had the feathers of every bird that he had successfully hunted tattooed on his arm.
Pretty sure that's Kyle.
Yeah. So, you know, so we spent a day with him, and sure enough, he took us to a cover that I would have not, it was classic woodcock, but it was higher ground, and very thick. You know, as you know, stem density, but dry. At least it looked dry. Crunchy leaves on the ground, and we moved 40 birds before lunch, and I was like, "Wow!" You know, and he started explaining to me that because it was a dry year, and because this was far more deciduous cover, that those leaves were now all on the ground, and they were holding moisture in the ground, and that the birds knew that they had to get to a place where there were still worms and they hadn't gone deep, you know? And so, I love that, you know, just, that was like something, wow, I've been doing this for all these years and it would have never occurred to me to come. I could have seen the cover from the road, if you could see it from the road, and said, oh, that's got the right stem density, it looks like, you know, but I would have said that was an afternoon cover, and this was first thing in the morning, and it was full of birds. So, I still love that whole aspect of it, and I still have that connection with Jerry, which is how I wound up in Scotland.
Scotland next, but how would you compare this? I could talk to you all day, Keith, but The mixed bag, you know, the chukar and hun and the rough grouse and woodcock, I mean, they're obviously different, but you've got a cool mixed bag hunt that people chase. Any similarities, anything that jumps out at you that's like different, or why you love one or the other or both? I know you love both.
I think that one of the reasons that I am so tied to the covey birds in the wide open now is because it's, I'll put it to you this way. When somebody asked me recently, they were hunting with me and my dog Quest, who is a Llewellyn setter, and he's a solid 300-yard dog. I've lost count of the number of times he's gone on point and he's at 450 or, you know, even 500. And they've asked me, is he my best dog? And I say, I've thought about this a lot because I've been very fortunate. I've had some great dogs. And I have to say, for what I want to do now, yes, he's the best dog I've ever had. But it's sort of a chicken and egg kind of thing, because when I started, I was in French Brittany's.
Yeah.
Dogs that were perfect for hunting woodcock and grouse. They stayed pretty close. They were very busy. great retrievers. And one of those, a dog named Ranger, I had for a long time said was the best dog I ever had. And he ran a little bit bigger, but he definitely broke his teeth on woodcock. That's where he started. And it was when we were living, I got him when we lived in Illinois, and all of my hunting was in Wisconsin. And so, okay. You know, outside the pheasant hunting that we did. And so now, you know, Quest is my, I would say, the best dog I've ever had, but he is not the best dog for hunting woodcock by any stretch of the imagination. So, you know, it depends on what I'm hunting. And you ask me now, well, my choice in dogs have evolved to fit what's most available to me.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of guys out here, I mean, that GSPs are the dog in where I live now. And most of the guys that I know hunt released pheasants. You know, they belong to clubs or they hunt when the state releases them. And they're great dogs for that. There's no question they're great dogs for that. And, you know, they're not that they're not good dogs for you know, hunting Huns and Chuckers. They,
right.
You know, I've seen some great ones. I've got a buddy right now who's got a Vizsla that I keep telling him he won the lottery when he got this dog, because she is unbelievable. From the time she was 8 months, she's been pointing, retrieving to hand. I mean, as a puppy, it was amazing to watch her develop. And you know, that's great. Any dog can be a great dog. I could have a setter that worked at 50 yards. I mean, and people,
right.
You know, you can either train them to do it or you know, some of them come out that way. But the two dogs that I have now, one Quest runs, you know, 200 to 300 yards, you know, kind of on a regular basis. And he has this magic of being able to, like, when he goes to 400 yards, I know it's because he's following his nose. He's found, you know, otherwise he doesn't get that far out. And then my other dog, Homer, he's kind of 150 to 200 yard dog. And he rarely gets out much further than that. But again, when he does, it's usually because he either found a scent or birds are running on him and he's just trying to keep up with them or whatever. So, but back to your question, I mean, I love hunting Huns and Chuckers. I kind of gravitate more to Huns now, only because, you know, I'm sort of, my legs aren't quite what they used to be. And the, you know, the Chuckers require a little bit more aerobic activity, I guess.
Yeah.
But, if I lived closer to woodcock cover, I'd hunt them. I'd certainly hunt them every year. I haven't been back there in 3 years, I think. So I'm thinking about coming out this fall though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is the Chucker and Hun mixed bag? Like, are they truly mixed bag in the sense that, like, you got a dog on point and you walk in, you don't know if you're going to flush a Chucker or a Hun, or is it not quite that much?
I would tell you it's very similar to grouse and woodcock.
Okay.
You know, if your dog goes on point in what you know to be really classic woodcock cover, it's probably a woodcock. It could be a grouse, right?
I mean,
certainly could be a grouse, and vice versa. You know, I've had the dog point woodcock in bigger timber, sort of on the edge, you know, in that edge between what would be better grouse cover and better woodcock cover.
Yeah.
And you don't know. And here it's similar. I mean, if your dog is pointing in the rocks up on the edge of a cliff, it's almost certainly going to be a chuckers. And if they're down in a draw, like a flat land draw, it's more likely going to be huns. So, but I've had 2 years ago, I had a deal where I shot, dog went on point and a covey got up and I dropped a bird, which turned out to be a chucker, and the chucker landed in the middle of a covey of huns and then they blew out. So not that I got to shoot again. It's not that cool of a story, but it was like that. That's how close together they were. You know, they were 30 yards apart on the same more or less hillside. So it does happen.
Yeah, love that. Well, that's definitely still on my bucket list, really, from talking to you and obviously many other Western bird hunters. But I just kind of love the idea of being able to get out there and chase those two birds. And well, I hope to do that. You've invited me out. And some of the hesitation has been, as the listeners know, I'm looking into new trucks and stuff. And my 2007 Sequoia has got 265,000 miles on it. So there's a little bit of hesitation to hop in the truck and drive to Wyoming, but we're going to solve that pretty soon. So,
well, not to hold your feet to the fire, but I've got a very good buddy from Oklahoma who, speaking of GSPs, I mean, he's a dyed in the wool. He's actually a horseback field trial judge. He's got a line of short hairs, and he's got dogs that have been champions. And ever since the first time I knew him through work years ago now, and he came out because he wanted to hunt huns, specifically huns, and he wanted to bring horses. And I was like, yeah, there's a lot of barbed wire fences out here. You'd be like, I don't know, you'd be looking for a place to get your horse, you know, to a gate all the time. So anyway, but he, every time that he came out here, he's been out here, I think every year for the last maybe 8+ years. And every year for the first like 6 of those, he was in a Ford F-150 that by the time he made his last trip, I think it had 460,000 miles on it. Yeah. He only got a new truck like 2 years ago, finally.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, it's going to happen, definitely. Because huns for sure, because I've got a taste of those, like on my prairie hunts, but it's so, so unpredictable. Just like, oh, there's a covey of huns, like every once in a while. Chucker, I've never really been in and around, so that would be new too. But
the thing for you to know is, just as if I was planning on coming out, you know, now that I don't have to go hunt where the birds are, the numbers are really bad, because I can go with the drop of a hat in the fall. In a good year, huns can be fantastic, but there's a lot of years that are not what I would call good years. And you can hunt long and hard and not do that well. And then, you know, but when the numbers are good, it's the same. It's, you know, it's like Montana. It was the same way. When it's good, it can be very good.
All right. Finally, an hour in. Let's talk Scotland. Skolopax. What?
Rusticola.
Rusticola. Okay.
Rusticola. Yeah.
So what was the spark? Was it that you had, you know, you had, again, you'd hunted them in the Great Lakes and then North American woodcocks, Skolopax minor, right? In the Louisiana, you did a few of those things, but was it just sort of a chance thing? Did you read an article? Like, what was the inspiration for making that trip?
I don't believe that I've ever actually read, you know, an article specifically about it.
I don't recall coming across a lot of stuff either.
But I but I had, you know, I mean, I always knew that there was this one other, you know, kind of woodcock, and it always seemed like it would be cool. I probably, when I first dreamed about going to the UK in general, a buddy of mine that I hunted with, who was a really avid golfer, we had sort of come up with this dream trip where we were going to go, you know, for the glorious 12th to shoot, to shoot grouse. And then we'd do it in Scotland so that he could go play St. Andrews. And, you know, all of that was going to happen. And then, you know, and this was actually quite a few years ago. And when I looked at that and saw what it cost to go shoot, even rough shooting grouse, it was pretty crazy expensive. At least I thought so back then. It's probably not that much different than a night at Pine Ridge, frankly. I mean, the you know, it seems, I don't know, I'm sure you don't spend as much time looking at it as I do, but it's kind of like whether you're hunting or fishing, wherever you're going, it's $1,000 a day. It just seems to be the magic number. It's a little more or a little less, but if you go into a lodge where you're going to stay, that's pretty much what it comes down to. That's not chump change. It's real money. So, but I had gotten to the point where when I retired, I started thinking that really the last thing on my bucket list of, you know, not that there's not plenty of places I still want to go and hunt, but the last thing that I'd been, you know, kind of always out there was woodcock in Europe. And I started checking into it several years ago, and I found very, very limited opportunities to, and in particular, it seemed like most of them were geared towards other Europeans, right? So like you could go to Lithuania and hunt, it seemed like everything I read was like they expected you to drive, bring your own guns and your own dogs. And kind they had
some clue what you were doing.
And then they would have places where you would hunt. And if you go on YouTube, for instance, you can see, you know, not unlimited, but quite a few, you know, videos of people hunting in Croatia and Lithuania and maybe, you know, Italy. You know, those woodcock are doing a similar migration to what ours do. They probably actually cover more ground if that's possible, because they could be way the heck up, you know, in Lapland and then making their way down to the Outer Hebrides in Scotland. So I had actually even contacted a number of outfitters and a couple of them were like just pretty almost standoffish. They were like, yeah, you know, don't even think about coming until, you know, January, and you know, the birds are, you know, not necessarily going to be here. Well, which is sure, that's what woodcock are. But yeah, I can remember this one guy that I had a email thing back and forth, and he was basically did everything but say, just stop calling me, you know, like I, you know, and to that end, you know, jump forward to the trip that we did in January, I was shocked when they said, you know, you're the first Americans we've ever had here. We're always going to remember you and Chip as the first Americans we ever guided. And I was like, wow, that's unusual. You know, I couldn't imagine how that could be. I had watched a fair number of those videos, and I had talked to, I had opened some conversations with the very few leads that I found on the internet in terms of woodcock hunting. Most of the sites that I found were like more, there were outfitters, but it was all about stags or, you know, big game, or driven shoots. And I, you know, I was adamant that I wanted to shoot over, you know, pointing dogs. And, in the end, you know, as you just alluded to, just by chance, Pheasant Fest 2 years ago, I was talking to Jerry, and he said, "Hey, by the way, I know you're crazy about woodcock. We're thinking of putting this trip together, and it will be an exploratory trip. We haven't done it before, but I've spoken to these guys. They seem to be, you know, pretty reliable and well-respected. Talked to some people who have hunted with them." And I just said, "I'm in, you know, just let me know." And then from there, you know, it kind of started to take shape, and it was a little rocky because the communication was not great, from the outfitter side. Jerry's also a pretty busy guy, so trying to get, you know, the three of us connected was tough. So we kind of talked about, I specifically said, they gave us three choices of where we might hunt: Lapland, Lithuania, and Scotland. And my choice was Scotland just because of the timing. Because if you started Lapland and then look at Lithuania and then Scotland, you know, you're looking at, it would be like saying, I want to hunt New Brunswick, or do I want to hunt South Carolina, or do I want to hunt Louisiana? You know, at least the way it was presented to us, Scotland was kind of the best bet because that's kind of where the birds are going to wind up. And they get there earlier than, like, they, you know, like, you would not be looking for woodcock in Louisiana in November. And yet the birds apparently start to show up in November in Scotland and then stay there pretty much through the winter. So,
okay. Yeah. So your chances of lining up were
right,
looking the best. Yeah.
The downside of that is that by January is the wettest month in Western Scotland, the wettest month of the year. It doesn't usually get snow because, I mean, you think about it, that's the end of the road for the birds there,
right.
You know, because it's a maritime climate and it's not, things don't freeze up usually.
Yep.
So
yep.
if they get snow, it doesn't last. And
was
so.
The January, was that your timeline? Is that when you had to hunt? Was it just like the best, or how did that?
It was when I wanted to hunt.
Okay. Because got stuff doing. You're doing hunting here.
Yeah, I don't like to leave really good hunting to, you know, to go to other hunting. And they also told us specifically that they don't hunt during the 2 weeks around Christmas. It's just a thing.
Yeah.
And so the birds, any birds that were there would be rested, and not have been bothered for a couple of weeks. All that, I don't know whether or not as it turned out for this year, the way things worked out, we were the first group to hunt that particular area with this outfitter. So, you know, he was saying, you know, we should be in pretty good shape because we haven't hunted it at all yet. So, but they had only been hunting this area the year before was their first, but it's a pretty storied.
So you were the, I heard you say you were the first group to hunt that particular area.
This year. And also, they only had hunted it 1 year prior.
Okay.
It was a new area that these guys had access to. They had been hunting. They've been running hunts in Scotland for many years. The company had been around for, I think, 15 years, they said.
Yeah.
But they had just gotten access to this the year before. So, and that played out a little bit into, I think, the choice of covers that we had, how far we had to drive, some of the places that we hunted, they had never been to before. You know, they were learning it same as we were as we went along. So, all in all, it was an awesome trip. I mean, it takes the whole thing of you know, anytime you go travel to hunt or fish, you know, there's a lot of things that can be controlled and a lot of things that can't. And the main thing that can't be controlled is the birds and the weather.
Yep.
So,
yep.
You know, you're always taking it, you know, that's a chance you take. So I've done this enough that I get that.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
we did have, it was pretty unusual though for this year.
Like
we
the snow and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah. And of course, like any good outfitter, they kept telling us that, well, yeah, this is not great, but it's way better than our other group that's in further east in Scotland because they're, everything's frozen. They
more,
can't hunt.
More inland.
They're going home.
Yeah. Well, yeah, of the people I know, you have done quite a bit. You dipped into Argentina, Canada. You've done a lot of traveling and hunting, and obviously there's definitely a unpredictability to it all.
Right.
You do what you can to sort of line things up
and
go for it.
Yeah, and you definitely it kind of brought me back to all of the years that I've done these trips. To most of them were DIY trips to hunt some bird somewhere else in the United States. And the whole time you're doing that when you're working for a living, you know, you pick your week, you know, it's a flip of a coin and that's when you're going. And you pick your week far enough ahead that you don't even know what the bird numbers might be like if you're going to go to Minnesota to hunt for a week in October, right? So you're hoping that the weather's good. You're hoping that the bird numbers are good. And that's, you know, that doesn't matter whether you go into Minnesota or Scotland. It's just that you could drive to Minnesota, and if it sucks, you could go, oh, let's go to Wisconsin or, yeah, you know, so.
All right.
Yeah.
Before we totally wrap this up, two things for sure that I want to get from you. Imagine a lot of people are listening here that are familiar with Great Lakes, rough grouse, woodcock cover. Compare and contrast the cover for me a little bit, and then I'm definitely curious about the dogs, the European European dog work, just sort of any sort of differences, nuances, but talk to me about the cover and the dogs and sort of the style of hunting as it relates to what we do back here.
Sure. And again, I'll preface this by saying that we hunted some very varied covers, you know, even within the time that we were there, from literally walking along the beach with you know, trees, you know, dense rhododendrons and birch trees, usually like, you know, 50 feet away where the ground would go up. So there was cover like that. There was cover that was like, I told you about the first day we hunted, 4+ inches of wet snow laying on big open fields of heather, which you couldn't tell it was heather because it was covered by snow and it looked like it was the ground. So when you got into it, you were actually, the snow was at your knees, even though the ground was two feet lower. So you were walking over really difficult, rocky terrain. And the bird dogs were basically going from cover to cover. Not that you couldn't find woodcock in the middle of the open, but most of them were along these little seeps and creeks.
There was like relatively clear objectives they were checking.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very much so. And that was, like I said, that was some of it. We also hunted some. We were in some like really big woods. I mean, stuff you would never ever think about hunting if you were in Minnesota, you know, big mature trees, conifers, with a lot of sort of hazel or a lot of rhododendron, which apparently is invasive, which is interesting. And they're, you know, if you know anything about what a rhododendron looks like, it's a very dense, fairly low, you know, cover, and it'd be like a mott of that stuff. And so we hunted the edges of fields, but like I said, we hunted some really big woods and a lot of up and down. It's affected the hunting in the sense that, like, we would have a dog on point on the side of a hill that was so steep and so muddy that you literally could not get to the dog. Like it was, it would have taken all four, you know, your feet and your hands holding on to roots to get to where the dog was. And it was like, there was no way to get the bird to flush. I mean, you know, and so then the guide would actually tell the dog to go, and the dog would not flush like a, you know, like a springer, but the dog would move forward and just kind of pressure the bird until the bird finally got up. And then in general, it got up low and fast and out the other side of the, it reminded me in that regard of a lot of anybody who's listened has ever hunted mountain quail. It's a lot like that. It's, they're in this lower stuff and you, the dog goes on point, the birds get out the other side and you never see them. So it was different. I made a point of telling the guide slack, the owners was our guide. Domenico was his name. And I said to him when he was asking me for feedback, I said, you know, I know a lot of people that could not do this, like physically could not for a week anyway. I mean, they might go do it for a day, but it was hard. You know, A, because it was so slippery a lot of time, but B, just like, okay, the dog's on point at the top of that hill, which you're going to almost have to crawl to get up and, you know, and you get there and the bird busts out. You know, it's just classic bird hunting stuff. It's just, it was quite challenging in that regard. And then the dogs, the guy, he had a built-in kennel in the back of his Mercedes van that held 10 setters, which were probably, if you're used to like Ryman setters, you can't, it wouldn't work. But these dogs were more like 35 pounds, most of them, you know, 40 pounds, maybe. Domenico is, he has his own kennel. He raises and trains and campaigns dogs. And I didn't get the full understanding of how it works, but he said that in Europe, pretty much each country has what they call mountain trials. So that's running dogs on wild birds only. And it, apparently it's basically grouse and woodcock mostly. And then each country has a series of trials. And then at the end of the season, they have the all Europe trials. And although Domenico was probably far too humble to say it, his wife told me that this one dog, I kept saying, this dog is amazing. This dog, I said, I would take this dog home. She said that dog was the number one dog in Europe last year. So wow. I don't think Domenico's going to let you take
part
home.
Ways with it.
So yeah. So
jeez.
And he had,
that's cool.
You know, he had everything for puppies in training to full on. None of his dogs were not good, and some of them were like this one. I mean, just incredible. He always hunted them in braces. He hunted them with orange vests on because you could not see them. It's in the heather, they were, that the heather was taller than they were, you know. So
yeah, I was wondering how the dogs moved around as you were describing that. Like
they run like my Britneys used to okay. run. I mean, they're just busy. They're just busy. Okay. And then when they go on point, of course they might be setting, actually yeah. laying down, but never with a high tail, always yeah, with a
no
low
12
tail.
O'clock tail.
No 12 o'clock tail. He says it's a waste of energy and it breaks up the beautiful lines that the dog has when its tail is straight out behind it.
Folks listening,
there you go. That's
it's
it.
A little
That's
antique
it.
Store find here. Here's your classic.
Yeah, there you go.
Low
That's
set.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were pretty much solid, but the birds often ran. We actually sometimes saw them run. I actually saw one bird that flushed off the front of his dog, landed quite close to me, because I was just the direction I was coming from. 4 inches of snow on the ground, and that bird hit the ground running like a pheasant. I mean, it just was, I mean, well, we never got to shoot at it, even though it was 10 feet from me when it, I mean, I didn't shoot when it flushed because the dog wasn't pointing, but yeah, that was a comment actually that he made. The guide said it was, he really appreciated, he wondered how common it was in America that people wouldn't shoot unless the dog was on point. Because at the same time we were hunting, they had a pair of Italian guys that had driven over and had their own dogs. And every day they were coming back with, you know, 4, 5, 6 birds between them. And we were coming back with, I mean, we killed 5 birds in a week total between 2 guys. And I, you know, I kind of said, wow, they, you know, they seem, they're getting into more birds or whatever. And he said, they're not like you. They're shooting at everything. He said probably they have not shot a bird over a point all week. He said because their dogs are not that good, and they're just, if the dog bumps a bird, they're shooting it. If they bump the bird, they're shooting it.
So it's just anything.
And he said much harder to guide. He said you guys are great. I would much rather guide people who are here because of they want to see the birds, the dogs work.
Yeah.
Then they want to kill birds, you know, that's all they're here for. So,
what did you use for guns over there? I forget. You didn't bring your own gun, did you?
One of my disappointments was, we spoke to them about guns ahead of time. They basically said, we shoot all Italian, 28s and 20s. I said, so like, Berettas and Benellis, and they said they'll be side by sides or over and unders. They would, you know, we have a variety of guns. I said, great. When we got there, I was talking to the gamekeeper ahead of time, and he said, yeah, I don't think I'm going to be able to get cartridges for a 28 gig, so you'll probably have to shoot a 20. And I said, that's okay. And then when we got together, they had a 12 and a 20. They were both very, very beat up old Turkish, like, you know, and very inexpensive starter guns. And the 20, which is what I shot, wound up, it was a kid's gun, and they had kind of cobbed a extra long slip-on pad to make it a little bit more usable, and it was, had not been well cared for. It needed a, in fact, I said to the guide after the first day, I said, this gun needs to be cleaned desperately, you know, and because it had all kind of gunk in it, and it wouldn't eject one of the shells because it was sticking, the ejector was sticking, so I could pull it out, but, you know, anyway, that was had to do with the fact that the Italian guys who were our outfitters, as it turned out, were renting guns from the gamekeeper. So it's a long story, but they weren't controlling. They didn't have guns for us at all. And we were getting our guns from this intermediary who just basically, and he was like, yeah, this is what I have. And we were like, well, that's not what we were told. And he's like, well, this is what I have. So
sounds like a perfect opportunity to supply them with some RFMs, maybe.
I would say I'm not sure what the real, at one point in time, they also told me that the reason that I couldn't shoot a 28 was because there was a guy in this other party that had a shoulder issue and he needed to shoot a light gun. And I was like, whatever. All I know is you know, you don't have the gun that I was told I was going to have. And, you know, that's one of those things where that distance, you know, and an ocean in between, you kind of, you know, you're going to be stuck with what you get. You may not be happy, but, you know, so, yeah. The other thing, which I think I told you about was just that which also was different than what they told us. they told us we were going to be staying in cottages by the water. And as when we showed up at in the low light, as we showed up in the snow, we wound up staying in this like monstrous estate from the mid 1800s that was like they Chip and I had a wing in this estate with like multiple bedrooms to choose from, our own sitting room, fireplaces in every room, cordon bleu trained chef running the kitchen. All that was over the top fantastic.
Were the fireplaces where the fire is rolling?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
And it was like, they're very, yeah, go ahead, light a fire.
That's cool.
Yeah. And one of the things they added on was one evening they said, would you guys like to shoot some geese? And we said, sure, why not?
You know,
at this point in time, we've been hunting woodcock for 4 days. We can shoot geese for a morning. And so they have these geese called gray leg geese that apparently are a problem in terms of depredation of crops. Okay. And so they had organized a big shoot where, I don't know, there was probably 10 or 12 guns spread out. And then they had beaters come through the fields because the geese were all out in the field in the morning. So that was kind of a nice little something different.
Something different. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have bird in hand, European woodcock. Tell me, I know it's a little larger, a little different feathering. That's about all I know. But what is the bird in hand like? And then table fare also.
Sure. So they're bigger than our American woodcock. Interestingly, for whatever reason, the males of the European woodcock, your Asian woodcock, I should be more specific. The males are actually larger than the females.
Okay, so it's the opposite of ours.
It's the opposite of our birds. And I don't have a big sample because, like I said, we shot 5 birds.
Yeah.
I did see more than that because we'd see the Italian guys come back with their birds every day. But I have a picture, which I may have sent you, and if not, I'll send it to you. But of 2 birds I shot one day, they were very different looking on the breast side. One of them, most of them have these barred breasts. And I shot one that was like, they actually commented, wow, that's unusual. It's like a creamy, you know, almost taupe colored breast on the one bird. And I asked, is that different? They said, well, no, they actually have a fair amount of variation. So they're not all exactly, I mean, I can't remember ever seeing an American woodcock that was not colored just like the last American woodcock I shot.
Yeah, not a lot of variation.
But here, like this picture that I have has both of them laying out breast up, and they're definitely look different. So, so definitely bigger. As I was telling you, not quite bird in the hand, but before the birds in the hand, the biggest single difference is that they don't make any noise when they get up. So they're getting out in thick cover and they're going low and fast. The other thing about the difference in the morphology is that their wings are significantly longer and more, almost hawk-like, tapered. They're longer and thinner than, you know, ours have these, you know, short, very, you know, stubby kind of wings. And these are very different than that. When you see them, you would not say, unless you can see the beak, you would never say that's a woodcock as it flew away, because the wings are very different.
I'm pretty sure Jerry Cable has one on the wall at Pine Ridge, because I was at Pine Ridge just a few days ago, and Dell and I were sitting, Dell Whitman and I were sitting on the couch, and Dell kind of looked up, and he's been there a million times. He's like, I think that's a really big woodcock. I was like, I think that's a Eurasian woodcock. But it, just like you're describing, I think it has the bars and the wings are like, they're real long and slender, or more so than.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. They are. And we only ate woodcock. We ate great the whole time we were there, but we only ate woodcock one night. And they were prepared in the classic, with the trail intact, which for those who don't know means that the intestines are left in, and they made a pate out of the heart and the liver, and chopped that up, and the classic. If you've read about it, it's they make that pate, they spread that on toast points, and the birds are roasted. And interestingly, the beak is used as a skewer so that they turn the bird's head back and the beak gets stuck through the leg to hold the head in place. And it's a very classic presentation, and they're cooked rare to medium rare, which as it should be, in my opinion. And yeah, it was good. I've eaten a lot of woodcock over the years and say it probably wasn't my favorite preparation, but it was something that I felt like we had to do because, you know, it was the classic. So
I haven't tried it myself. What do you, are you a heart and liver guy? Like, do you keep that out of birds that you regularly hunt?
You know, it's funny you ask that because 2 years ago when we were in partridge camp, which to me means huns and chuggers,
yeah.
I had a buddy coming out who was going to spend a couple of days with us. And he tends to be, like I am, sort of an amateur chef. And he said, how's the hunting going? I said, it's going pretty well. And he said, well, make sure you're saving the hearts. And I was like, really? And he said, yep, I got a new recipe. Make sure you're saving the hearts. So we started to save the hearts. And when he was there, we shot some more birds. And he made this great little kind of a scrapple thing out of the hearts and with a little bit of sausage in it and shallots, wine. Came together very quickly. The kind of hardest part was basically cleaning the hearts up before you threw them in the pan whole. You didn't chop them up at all. Yeah. So they went in whole and it was just on bread and delicious. And I make sure we save the hearts now. So.
Yeah, it sounds good. I like them. Like my son, he shot that turkey last week and, we saved the heart and liver out of that. And I like it. I don't do anything super special. Usually like saute them and onions, mm-hmm. olive oil, that kind of thing. But I haven't made a lot of pâtés, but.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's good. And I definitely try to use everything I can out of the birds that I shoot. So, you know, it all goes into something from stock to, you know, finished roasting birds. So, yeah.
Well, with Scotland, Eurasian woodcock out of the way, is there anything left on Keith's list that's like really at the forefront right now? Or are you just looking forward to fall in the uplands?
Yeah, just pretty much just looking forward to fall. I've got every year I do a fishing trip. So this year, we're going to Iceland in June, July. So we're going to do that for a week. And then because Iceland is a geologic phenomenon, myself and my buddy Chip we met in grad school for geology. We both have masters in geology. And so we added some days onto the end to go check out all the volcanics and the faults and all that good stuff. So that's what I've got until fall, and fall will be chasing birds. I'm in the midst of kind of putting that list together. I'm thinking about coming out to Minnesota. The last few years have been so rough for quail down, at least for Mearns quail, that I probably won't do that this year. So, but there's plenty of other stuff to do.
Well, yeah. Clearly you and I could keep at this for a while, but I got dogs to run. Hartley's getting vocal and I'm sure you do as well. So I really appreciate you taking the time to join us once again, Keith. Always appreciate your stories and your insights and wisdom. Keep in touch about this fall. I will do the same.
Will do.
If I work up the courage to head west, I would love to do it.
Yeah. Anytime, man.
All right, buddy. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. That does it for this episode, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.
All right.
Hey, everyone. It's your host, Nick, here with one more thing before you go. I want to thank you for joining us for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes of this episode to learn more. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I'll send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you from me Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.